So this evening, talk about meditation for a few minutes, and then we'll have some guided meditation, and then after that, some Dharma talk. When we come to meditate, we are trying to understand ourselves. And we learn to understand ourselves through an open-hearted and gentle sense of being with, awareness of, we make room inside our hearts for forgiveness, for quietness, for compassion. We allow these qualities to settle, grow, come to fulfillment, and through them we learn to see who is it that the mother knows? Who is it that the mother understands the best? And of course, that's their own child. Understanding of someone else's child is inevitably weaker, shallower, more distant. So why do we understand our own child? Because we have that love. We have that compassion. It's not because that child is any intrinsically better or worse than any other child. Not because it's any intrinsically more worth understanding. But it's simply because that bond of love makes the mind linger in contemplation. It's like if you go to an art gallery and you see maybe a dozen paintings that don't do anything for you, and you just skip on past them, and then finally you come to that one painting that somehow grabs your attention. Maybe you see a painting of Turner where the light from the ocean is dissolving everything in the frame and leading the eye beyond the objects in the frame into a sense of radiance, which is somehow suggested through that mere application of pigment onto canvas. And then that suddenly arrests the mind. That dissolving of the world into radiance, somehow that compels one's attention. It compels our awareness to linger and absorb. So just as a great artist will use the same crude material, the brush, the pigment, the canvas, and will, through their sensibility, they can transform those crude materials to suggest something far greater. And so too, when we're meditating, we take the crude matter, the raw material of experience, and we craft that with a sense of wonder and a sense of a sense of awe. We use the very ordinary facts of our experience, the breath, or thought in the mind. These things which are so much a part of our experience that normally we can't even see them. We're just swimming in it like the fish that can't see the ocean. And we take these raw materials and we try to fashion that into the art of consciousness. We fashion that until it makes a vision of the inside of our own consciousness. And just like the works of Turner will make the canvas will dissolve into light, and the solid objects which are depicted on the canvas in a way defeated or overcome by that most ephemeral suggestion of light, which is not merely ghost-like and elusive in itself, but even more profoundly is something which allows the very existence of the solid objects to be seen or to be known. So the solid objects, the solid world is only revealed in the light, in vision. And yet through that same light they will be dissolved. In exactly the same way in the mind, that the solid objects in our mind, the breath, the body, the thoughts, these things that are concrete and stable, part of our experience, these things are only illuminated and made known in the mind through the light of consciousness. And it's that same light, when it strengthens and shines, when it becomes purified and stronger, that same light will dissolve the entire concrete world into nothingness. Just like if you're on the beach in the middle of the day and the light of the sun is so bright that you can't see anything. It's shining off the ocean, shining off the white sand with such intensity that you have to close your eyes. And even then it's too bright. So to understand this, to be able to embody this kind of experience, we need to bring an attitude of reverence and humility into our meditation. We can't treat it like a mechanical or reductive process. This will only have very limited effects. There's something about the process of meditation which, when it deepens and as it becomes more more real, more as it gets to the heart of the matter, as it peels off the layers of delusion around the mind, then the further we go in, the more it evokes this sense of awe or this sense of wonder. And this is nothing else than the sense of, in the sense that this world within which we are trapped and which defines and limits our lives and the nature of our experience, this very same world conceals within it the secret of liberation. And it's only through that thin veil of delusion, that shadow that's cast by the ignorance in our mind, that stops us from seeing these things. As the light grows, as our minds become attuned to the purity of consciousness, then we feel like we're coming home. We feel like we've been betrayed. We've been sold false goods our entire life. We've been under the sway and the influence of Mara for our entire life. And Mara has sold us these shoddy, fake, imitations. really been nothing standing between us and this light and purity of consciousness. There's no solid barrier. There's no real reason why we can't just experience that. It's just right there. It's just right there. All we need to do is peel back the veil, and there we look. But sometimes that's the hardest thing for us to do. That thing which is the easiest and the most flimsy is also the thing which is the hardest, the most essential. And the thing where it's not hard because the thing itself is hard. There are people who can just do this. They can just sit down and just go into samadhi. Just concentrate your mind, go into the light. There it is. That thing itself is not hard. What's hard is the fear in the mind, the fear of letting go, the fear that what will happen if that light expands and grows and grows and grows and the whole world disappears into that light? What happens if there's nothing left? And so we are afraid. We pull back from the edge. We don't want to commit ourselves. We don't have enough faith. We're too busy rationalizing and explaining away the reasons why we can't do these things. And we tell ourselves over and over again, I can't do this because it's my past karma. I can't do this because there's too much work in this monastery. I can't do this because it's my character. I can't do this because, and on and on and on go the rationalizations. And it's all rubbish. All of it is rubbish. Because the mind is right there, and it's those very rationalizations that are hiding it from you. It is that act of trying to pretend that these things are not real. It's that very act which is the veil itself. It's that very act which is ignorance. It's that very act which projects our own fears, failures, defilements, delusions out onto the world and pretends that they're a real thing in the world. And that is the root of all our problems. And if you can't get over that, then you will never see what that is like. You'll never see what the truth is like. And stop kidding yourself. We talk in Buddhism, we talk about meditation. We have a whole complicated array, a very sophisticated and tried and tested and proven, empirically justified, rational, and verifiable ways of talking around the subject. And with the advent of modern times, we develop even more sophisticated ways of avoiding the issue. We can avoid the issue by doing cross-cultural or comparative religious things. We can argue about, is this experience in Buddhism the same as XYZ experience in Hinduism or in Sufism or something like that. We can avoid the topic by doing Buddhist psychology and trying to work out whether these things are the same as various psychological states and how they relate and so on. We can avoid the issue by doing science and by getting meditators and sticking them in a laboratory and sticking machines on them. And these are all well and good, but they all miss the point. When mind is free of these veils and these defilements and these obstructions, then the mind becomes concentrated, goes into samadhi, and the mind that has samadhi will see things as they really are. As we saw very plainly described in the Artakanagara Sutta yesterday, after the entrance into each of the jhanas and other states of samadhi, and the mind will investigate that this is conditioned, this is impermanent, this is subject to cessation. And then standing in that, the defilements come to an end. And so this is pulling the rug out of underneath of experience. Not leaving us anything in this world to remain attached to. And so this kind of experience is very often symbolized as death. And so when we see the image of a Buddhist monk or a nun, you know, we have this association. We've seen monks and nuns our whole lives in different circumstances, and we recognize that image. But behind that image there lurks all of these different layers of association which don't occur to our conscious mind. But these robes, these symbols that we have, the robes and the shaven head, these are traditionally in Indian culture, these are the symbols of the condemned criminal, the hunter, the executioner, the sacrificial victim, the exile, the corpse. These are the associations, the connotations of these robes and shaven head. So it's not we're not wearing the crown and the robes of the king. We're not wearing the badges of status and royalty. We're wearing the rags of the lowest of the low, the worst kinds of outcast who are completely rejected by civilized society, and we've completely died to the normal life. And this is why the robes, these symbols, retain such a very powerful impact on our mind, even in our modern times. There's something quite unforgettable about it. And of course, it's easy enough to adopt the external forms, but to actually embody that is something else entirely. To actually realize that if we want to follow this path in its fullness and in its depth, then we're going to have to die to ourselves, die to our families, die to our societies, die to our ideas, die to our opinions, die to our education, die to our emotions, die to our thoughts. Until, as you know, that in the deepest states of samadhi, of concentration, it's almost impossible medically to tell the difference between somebody who's in deep concentration meditation and somebody who's dead. And even a doctor would find it difficult to tell the difference between these two. Again, what we're doing here is we are taking up, to accomplish this dying to the world, okay, this state of total transformation, to accomplish this, we have to live fully. And we have to not merely develop, we have to totally embody the essence of life within us. So the meditations we use, the breath meditation, focus on life. Breath is life. We're focusing on that life, and through that life, through that total life, we come to death. Or we focus on metta, loving kindness. We focus on that heart of happiness and joy within us. That sense of boundless cherishing. That utterly tender and naive emotion, that just giving up into the very, very childlike, babyish emotion, playfully, and through that allowing everything else to die. And so, of course, all of these are paradoxes. What do you expect? The further you go into practice, the deeper you go into the depths of the Dhamma, then the more paradoxical it becomes. And the more suspicious we should be of any kind of formula that claims to have got it all worked out and to be able to present it in a consistent, clear and rational way. Because as soon as you think you've done that, immediately start looking If you come across anyone or any system or any teaching that claims to have got it all wrapped up in that way, start looking around the edges, looking around the corners, and you'll immediately see these very curious and very suggestive like leakings, these points where the rational explanation, this very sensible way of putting it, starts to leak out, or the world starts to leak in, or one or the other, depending which way you want to look at it. And so these points are very important. This is like the Achilles heel. It's only one spot, but that one spot betrays the nature of the problem. And this was precisely Gödel's theorem in mathematics, was that you cannot fundamentally impossible to develop a mathematics which is entirely consistent and describes the world in a straightforward way. So even within mathematics, this is accepted and basically regarded as a proven theorem. So much more so in the spiritual world. We do not do the Dhamma a service, we do not do the Buddhism a service by pretending that it's science. And when we look at the books written by modernist Buddhists that try to prove that Abhidhamma is ultimate science and Buddhism is a scientific method and all of these kinds of things, all you hear there is like this craven subservience to some kind of idealized projection of what modern science is. And people who argue those things typically have very little or no understanding of actually what science is, and so they end up with both bad science and bad Buddhism. It's not to say that there isn't a connection between Buddhism and science. Of course there is. But it's to say that that relation is not one which you can describe in such simplistic terms. And it certainly isn't the case that Buddhism needs to go running to science for justification and backup. The success of Buddhism, the success of the Dhamma is revealed within each one of us. When we sit down to meditate, when the balm of the Dhamma actually succeeds in solving the problems of our lives, then in that way the Dhamma is proven, and not by getting somebody in a laboratory and sticking electrodes into them. So the most direct way, the most real way of verifying and proving the truth of the Dhamma is just by this very dissolving of the world in the light of consciousness. And to do this, we need to start out meditation with those kinds of qualities which we're trying to develop. You can't hope to find unity and oneness in your heart if your thinking is very divisive. If you always see the world in black and white categories, you can't hope to develop a universal loving kindness if you're constantly denigrating and putting down and being cynical and negative towards others. It's just a joke. You can't even get even close to it. This is obvious. The they use this phrase in that I've heard the psychologist use, unconditional positive regard. And this is the attitude that a therapist should have towards their patient or their client, as the language goes these days. Unconditional positive regard. And it's a very nice description of, as Buddhist practitioners, what our attitude should be generally towards ourselves, towards each other as members of the community, towards other Buddhists in other places, and people of other religions and faiths, and just humanity, sentient beings, everyone, unconditional positive regard. There was a play made once, many years ago, and it was a version, it was done by the BBC, I can't remember what it was called now, but it was a version of the life of Jesus, and it was based on a scene taken from a very well-known novel whose name escapes me now. Anyway, the novel was by a Russian novelist about the devil let loose in Moscow in the 1920s. I can't remember what it was off the top of my head, but anyway, that novel had a scene in it about the life of Jesus and his trial. And this particular play depicted that, and Jesus with Pontius Pilate. And I remember, out of all of it, I remember that Jesus in that was very badly mistreated by the Roman soldier, and beat him or whatever. And Jesus was being interviewed by Pontius Pilate, and Pilate was trying to understand Jesus as depicted in this particular episode. And Jesus said something along the lines of that we should love everybody. I can't remember exactly what he said. And Pontius Pilate said, "What, even that soldier?" And at that point, I still remember that point, it was very well acted by the actor playing Jesus. Just at that moment, you could see like this, almost just like this cloud drifted past his brow at that moment. And that's all. And then just kind of drifted by and went out. You know, so this is that's that response to somebody who'd just been beating, brutalizing, condemning him. And so his response, when, you know, called to challenge, to say, you know, do you really have unconditional love even for that person? And then the response, just that little hint of a cloud across his face, and then that's all. So very often we fail this challenge, don't we? We want to develop metta, we want to develop unconditional love, but it's just so hard. And we're just challenged so often. And so we develop these very negative attitudes and habits of mind. And we let them get out of hand. We let them erupt into very unwholesome habits of speech. And they create a negative energy environment within ourselves, and spill out and share that with others, rather than sharing gentleness, kindness, positiveness, supportiveness with others. Where we end up sharing this kind of negative and cynical and degrading speech, which creates creates a harsh and harsh and harmful violent, emotionally violent environment. And so when this is happening, when we can see this is happening, we need to reflect on that and we say, okay, Ara Samadhi Maha, as the Buddha said, the mind which is like this, Ara Samadhi Maha, far from Samadhi. Ara Samadhi Maha, far from Samadhi. So we need to move from there and realize those same, what are those qualities we want to bring to our meditation? How do we take this coarse, rubbishy, crappy mind that we all have and that we've all been conditioned with? How do we treat, how do we take that and transmute that, transform that into the gold of samadhi? Like the Buddha said, like, you know, taking raw earth, smelting it and skimming off all the impurities until all that's left is radiant, fiery, molten gold. Like Turner would take the paint and the canvas and the brush and transform it into a vision of light, dissolving the world. That attitude of mystery, of awe, of wonder, partly this is one of the words this is captured in is the word, partly the word pasada, which it's a very beautiful word. It partly means faith and also means clarity. And this is one of the words that's characteristic of samadhi, especially occurs in the second jhana. And so, you know, we to evoke this pleased contemplation, this joyous, uplifting, devoted, humble sense of wonder and joy with one's meditation. And not just with the meditation, not just, you know, I'm going to do whatever crap I want the rest of the day and then come and sit meditation and expect to get anywhere. It's just Looney Tunes. It doesn't happen. Bring that same attitude with you during the day. And I think this is one of the a limitation with an excessive emphasis on what's often called mindfulness in daily life. And so in some approaches to meditation, what's emphasized very much is, you know, you're aware of your postures, where your hand is, where your foot is, and so on and so forth. You know these things, and you understand where things are. It's a very kind of almost clinical knowing, you know, following where you're going. And of course, it's good to do that. There's nothing wrong with that, but it shouldn't be emphasized exclusively. What's at least as important, and this is something that's quite obvious in the text, and it's also more than obvious in the lives of people who actually have good samadhi, that what's much more important is that sense of givingness and like a gentle openness of heart, which is brought to everything that one does, everything one says. You know, overcome, you know, this kind of humility that overcomes expectations of how things should be. And just allows things to unfold. You know, like when I was in Sydney on Saturday and was kind of stuck in the hall, I didn't know what to do. And then it just occurred to me, well, I just, you know, I have this inheritance that I've has been passed down to me from the Buddha and from the great tradition. And, you know, I'm a monk, and when it comes down to it, I'm not a businessman. I'm not someone who has to organize every last detail in my life. I'm not somebody who has to have everything under control. But I'm a monk, and that means that I'm happy to just cast myself on the oceans of uncertainty. And so after I was sitting in the hall and trying to think, well, I'll do this, or I'll do that, or I can do that, and they kind of all those plans exhausted, I realized I couldn't do anything. And then I thought, okay, well, this is my inheritance, this pair of feet. This is what I've got. Don't have a mobile phone. Don't have internet connection. I don't have, willing lay people who are going to come and grovel and cater to my every whim and say, you know, whatever you want, Bhante, I'll get it for you, and, you know, please allow me to mortgage my house so that you can be more comfortable. I didn't have anything. I just had a pair of feet. So, okay, so I'll just walk down the road. And that's that moment when that shift in the mind happens, where instead of trying to control the environment and impose your will on it, that there's a sense of acquiescence. And this very, very light-hearted, very joyous feeling just to walk down the road. And there's nothing behind you, nothing before you. There's just that act of walking. And that itself becomes, at that moment, is your life, is your Dhamma, is your path. And when we bring that attitude, that moment in the mind, bringing that moment into our meditation, that moment, which is not doing a meditation, which is not trying to achieve jhanas, which is not trying to get enlightenment, which is not telling yourself why you can't get this state of meditation, it's not blaming others for your problems, but it just lets go. It just turns and says, there's nothing more than this moment, here, now, this mind, this body, what is here right now. This is where the Dhamma happens. And wherever you are, whenever you are, whoever you are, it always happens in the same way. It doesn't matter if you're the Buddha or one of the great disciples. It doesn't matter if who you are, when you are. Dhamma always happens in that same place. It happens in that place when you let go. And from there, the path becomes very smooth. Those roads that were rough, they become even. The seas that were violent, they become stilled. The winds that are raging, are appeased. The storm in your heart becomes a clear sunny day. Just like that. Just like that. Not in any other way. Not through any other means. just like that.